NPR's Throughline podcast sort of feels like stepping into a time machine. Each episode, our Peabody Award-winning show travels beyond the headlines to answer the question, how did we get here? Listen to one of Apple's favorite podcasts of 2024 by searching for Throughline on Apple Podcasts or on your favorite podcast app.
The Houthis in Yemen say they will retaliate after President Trump ordered deadly strikes.
Clearly, Trump wants to show that he is the new sheriff in town.
I'm Marco Werman. More on U.S. military actions in the Red Sea. Also, hundreds of people deported by ICE are now in a notorious prison in El Salvador.
Prisoners never see the light of the sun. They don't go out of their cells. They don't have legal assistance.
In Northern Europe, they're building the longest underwater tunnel ever. It's also way down below the ocean surface.
At the deepest point, you'll have 40 meters of water above you. So you're quite deep down.
And we'll hear about Jewish life in the Ukrainian capital during a time of war. Plus, abracadabra in North Korea, a Western magician wins over crowds. All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being here on this Monday. Carolyn Beeler is off this week. Grief and outrage in North Macedonia after a weekend fire at a nightclub killed nearly 60 people in the city of Kochani and injured 150 more. Witnesses say pyrotechnics on stage during a concert lit the ceiling on fire, engulfing the building, resulting in a stampede. Since then, resignations, widespread allegations of corruption, and people being brought in for questioning. A mother of one of the victims told the Associated Press, I had a happy life. I had enough money. Now my child is gone, my only child. Guy Delaunay has reported in the Balkans for more than a decade. He says Club Pulse was well known in the region.
I know people in the music industry in the region, and they tell me that this venue in Kochani, the Pulse nightclub, was renowned as being one of the best nights out in the country, that it was a place which had a lot of good acts playing there, was very well kitted out inside in terms of the staging and the lighting and so forth, but that the owner hadn't put anything into the structure of the building itself, and that's clearly the problem.
I mean, aside from pointing the finger at corruption, what else has the government said, and how have they responded?
Well, the government said there'll be no mercy for people who are involved in this. It doesn't matter what your political party is, what your affiliation is, your posting, your name or your surname. If you are found in some way to be responsible for this, we will bring you to account. And that's the message which is going out. But as I say, people are going to be raising their eyebrows, if not rolling their eyes at this, because all of the political parties in this country, I don't think any of them can say that they're squeaky clean. So that's why I think you're going to see a very big public outpouring of grief and anger in the coming days.
Guy, what are these specific corruption and negligence allegations that have been made about this club?
Well, specifically, that the owner shouldn't have had a license. And the reason that he's got a license is because money changed hands. I mean, that's been actually raised by government ministers. That's what they say suspect happened in that case. People in this town have been saying, why didn't the mayor inspect it? He's the highest ranking official in Kochani. Why was he allowing such a facility to operate on his patch? The mayor, meanwhile, has resigned, saying that he is shocked and heartbroken.
Yeah, so a nightclub with apparently an illegitimate license. What's happening with the owners now?
Well, the owner's in custody, and he's being questioned by police, and he's one of more than 10 people who've so far been taken in by police, and one suspects there will be more, because the nightclub itself is now the site of a criminal investigation. If you were to go there now, you'd find it the approach road to it is taped off. You can't even see it from the road, because the police are behind that security tape, and it is a crime scene, and that's how they're treating it. You've got forensic investigators, and the police are going to carry on with their investigation of it. They'll be pulling in anybody they suspect had anything to do with the fire at the venue and seeing if they need to be brought to account before the courts.
We heard that very angry comment from a mother earlier. I mean, what kind of impact do you think this tragedy could have on the government there in North Macedonia?
Well, the thing is, as I mentioned, you're going to have a very large protest movement, quite potentially. People have seen what's happened in Serbia, neighboring Serbia, where there's been a very large protest movement over the past 5 months. Following a disaster there at a railway station, and people held government corruption to account for that. And they've been on the streets ever since. And we saw hundreds of thousands of people on the streets of the capital, Belgrade, at the weekend. And people in Kochani have said to me, we should learn from what people are doing in Serbia. We should learn from our neighbours. If we don't get satisfaction from the authorities, we should take it to the streets ourselves.
Guy Delaunay reports in the Balkans region for the BBC. Under the quiet of night on the Red Sea, this has returned. That's a precision missile being fired from the deck of an American warship. President Trump ordered strikes this weekend against the Houthis, who control much of Yemen, in an effort to deter attacks on commercial cargo ships. More than 50 people were killed. The Houthis say women and children were among them. Abdulghani Al-Iryani is with the Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies. I asked him what's known about the damage caused by U.S. strikes.
Bombing struck offices of the Houthis and military arms depots and other camps around the country. It was the most intensive bombing by the Americans since the beginning of this conflict.
Didn't those Houthi salvos on ships seem to simmer down a couple of months ago? So why did the Trump administration see the need to use military force against the Houthis in Yemen now?
I believe that the U.S. was planning this for a long time. But since nothing has happened on the part of the Houthis in a few days before the bombing started, I'm guessing that it was decided on the basis of domestic imperatives.
And am I accurate about that? Had those Houthi attacks on ships in the Red Sea slowed down after January?
Yes, they have. Everything stopped. When the Israelis imposed total siege on food and water and medicine to Gaza, the Houthis threatened to start again. But I don't believe that they have done anything significant. There was a report of one missile that was struck over the Sinai Peninsula, but that's nothing to justify this level of intensity of the bombing campaign.
Just as a reminder, the Houthis said they were attacking any ship on the Red Sea that had a connection to Israel and firing at them in solidarity with Hamas's war against Israel. We saw the Biden administration carry out retaliatory strikes to counter the Houthis. I'm wondering how effective those strikes were in terms of protecting commercial shipping lanes in the Red Sea.
They didn't do much. There's very little that the military approach to these attacks could do. The Houthis continued to stop most of the marine traffic from Red Sea going towards Israel. So it was obvious that the only solution was to find a political solution for the Palestinian question.
So what would you say is different about the Trump administration's approach to Yemen compared to the previous U.S. administration?
Clearly, Trump wants to show that he is the new sheriff in town, and he wants to flex his muscles. He could cause significant damage to the Houthi infrastructure, but he would not be able to stop them from carrying out attacks. When you consider what is needed for attacks on passing ships, it's a few drones and a few missiles that could be transported in one container.
We should remember that Iran supports the Houthis, so I'm wondering how much of all this is a message to Iran or is about Iran.
Of course, yeah. But, you know, Trump threatened that he will go after Iran if the Houthis do not stop. I don't believe that, because if he had intention to go after Iran, he would go after Iran without having to use the Houthis as an excuse.
At the same time, as you probably know, President Trump has also sent a letter inviting Iran's government to engage in talks about its nuclear program. So do you see a strategy here?
Well, I see a Trump strategy, which is to flood the zone with all kinds of conflicting messages and let people be confused.
Abdulghani Al-Iryani is a senior researcher at the Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies. He spoke with us from Cairo. He's a race-baiting politician and no longer welcome in the country. That's how Secretary of State Marco Rubio described South Africa's ambassador to the U.S. in a social media post on Friday. Ambassador Ibrahim Rasool has now been expelled from Washington, according to a statement from South Africa's president on Saturday. Cyril Ramaphosa called the decision regrettable. The State Department did not immediately explain the thinking behind the expulsion, but Rubio's social media posts also accused Rasool of hating America and President Donald Trump. The statement from South Africa's president says his government remains committed to building a mutually beneficial relationship with the United States of America. South Africa is one of the wealthiest and most developed countries on the African continent, and yet it's also dealing with a serious water crisis. Drought and climate change are two contributing factors, but they're not the only ones. And now South Africa's main economic hub is bearing the brunt of the problem. Elna Schutz reports from Johannesburg.
Hairdresser Ali John is happy that she's able to wash her clients' hair using water straight from the tap today. Often when there's a water outage, she must bend over a bucket.
I have water stored in the garage for an emergency, so I have to heat and bring it into the bucket and use it on my clients. So it's very uncomfortable.
The longest John has been out of water has been 3 days. Her clients are understanding, but it threatens her business. She's looking into getting a personal water tank, which will cost around $1,000. Others drill wells, which is more expensive. But the problem is much bigger than what some individuals can pay for. It starts at the source. The state-owned entity Rand Water stores, treats and brings water to Johannesburg's municipality. Feriel Adam is an analyst with the civic action group Water Can. She says there's been almost a decade of corruption and underspending on water and sanitation.
And what that meant for us is that you had a population growth, you had infrastructure deterioration, but you didn't have enough water for supply or for demand.
But Rand Water says Johannesburg residents should take some of the blame. Spokesperson Makanosi Maru points to statistics showing South Africans, and Johannesburg residents in particular, consume more water than the world average.
There is enough water. The problem is the consumption. We are consuming more water than we are supposed to be consuming.
Maru says it's not just about consumers. A lot of the problem lies with municipalities. In Johannesburg, that agency is Joburg Water, marketing and communications manager Nombuso Shabalala.
We've got aged infrastructure in the city of Johannesburg, and most of the challenges stem from that.
So a lot of the water never even reaches people. Estimates say up to a third or more in the province is lost to leaks, but some of the water is stolen. This problem of people stealing water is so prominent that Joburg Water has teams constantly trying to stop it. Tebo Mokwena, manager for Illegal Connections, stands next to a house while team members dig up the current water connection and local police stand watch in case residents cause trouble.
The excavations are still underway, but we are able to see that there is an illegal connection, so they've been using our water without getting charged for it.
The digging reveals a professional-looking but illegal connection to the municipal system. Mokwena's team opens up the connection and caps it. Once the owner pays up any outstanding fees and penalties, the team will come back and reinstall a lawful connection. At another building, the illegal connection is plain as day. Residents have attached a hose to a fire hydrant. The team serves them a notice but can't turn off the water supply to a hydrant. That would be a fire hazard.
They're likely to stay illegally connected, but internally we do have processes where we do go and reinvestigate properties that we've disconnected to ensure that they don't reconnect themselves.
Sometimes buildings are disconnected and illegally reconnected multiple times over the years. It seems like a never-ending battle. Between leaks and illegal connections, Joburg Water loses almost half its revenue. Richard Messner is a professor at the University of South Africa, specializing in the politics of water management. He says Johannesburg must spend more money to build and fix infrastructure. But there's another big problem as well.
There has to be a change in consumer behavior in both the private sector as well as the government sector, where government buildings or government departments don't pay their bills. Those things need to happen immediately, those two things.
While change is possible and happening, it's slow. Recently, South Africa's president established a new water research management agency he hopes will bring in more investment and streamline how water authorities are managed. But until that is up and running, Joburg residents are likely to sit with dry taps for a long while. For The World, I'm Elna Schutz.
A Danish magician was curious if he could wow audiences in North Korea. Hilarity ensues. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Europe, construction is underway on the longest underwater tunnel ever built. It'll go under the Baltic Sea and will connect Germany and Denmark by road and rail. Developers say it will fundamentally change travel in the European Union for the better, cutting the time it takes to get from Hamburg to Copenhagen by half. The World's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel has our story.
If the idea of driving more than 11 miles through the ocean terrifies you, you're not alone.
I mean, when you drive through the Fehmarn Belt Tunnel, at the deepest point, you'll have 40 meters of water above you. So you're quite deep down.
Henrik Vincentsen is CEO of the Danish state-owned company behind the Fehmarn Belt Link, which is set to be a marvel of engineering. With an estimated price tag of more than 7 billion euros, covered mostly by Denmark and the EU, the project is a massive undertaking. Footage of construction crews shows them casting the structure of the tunnel in concrete. They're building it in 79 pieces, each weighing nearly 75,000 tons or 150 million pounds. The tunnel will travel through a trench at the bottom of the Baltic, locked into place with stone and sand covering the top. Fehmarn's CEO, Vincentsen, says he understands the idea is intimidating, but there's nothing to fear.
In terms of safety, it's probably some of the most safe areas to actually drive because it's well designed.
The tunnel's traffic, he says, is split in two separate roadways, making it easier to deal with any issues underwater. There are also monitors throughout in case of emergency. Danish advocates were initially skeptical of the proposal to connect islands between northern Germany and southern Denmark, especially in the early days, when developers were thinking of building a bridge over the water, rather than a tunnel.
We were against it because we think it was maybe destroying the nature and acting like some sort of barrier for the stream of water from in and out of the Baltic Sea.
Speaking from his home overlooking the Baltic, Michael Cruz of the Danish Society for Nature Conservation says he worried about massive ships hitting the structure, causing major environmental problems.
If you can imagine a Russian supertanker coming through the Baltic Sea and is making contact with the bridge, it could give a lot of problem with the environment, with all that oil and so on.
The state-owned company, Fehmarn AS, eventually made concessions, deciding to go with a tunnel. And Cruz tells me Danish advocates are now on board. He looks forward to being able to zip between Denmark and Germany without taking a ferry or finding a much longer car route. He says that will ultimately be better for the environment and foster cultural exchange.
There's two cultures meeting in one project. It's almost you are making a new country, a new culture, a united culture.
But if you talk to Germans, you'll find the culture isn't so united. Malte Ziegert is with Germany's oldest and largest environmental association, NABU. He says while a tunnel is better than a bridge environmentally, the project will mostly benefit the Danish side by creating jobs in one of the country's poorest areas near the bridge entrance. The German side, he says, doesn't need it.
The area of Ostholstein, which is the region actually on the German side, is very, very much dependent on tourism. And lives on tourism mainly and on farming.
Siegert worries rather than helping the tourism industry, the construction and traffic jams caused by the tunnel will destroy the area's charm for vacationers. Still, the project's developers are hoping to open the tunnel to trains and cars in 2029. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
Last month, North Korea opened its doors to foreign visitors for the first time since the start of the COVID pandemic. Then the government quickly reversed course, closing its doors to tourists for the foreseeable future. This back-and-forth policy is typical of a regime that's never really been comfortable with outsiders. Most everyone who does make it into North Korea is limited to a stale propaganda tour. But The World's Patrick Nguyen spoke to someone who went a little deeper.
Here's something you don't hear often. North Koreans squealing with excitement. That's a classroom of teenage students reacting to a magic trick. Some are giggling so hard, they're falling over. And the magician, some Danish guy in a t-shirt.
My name is Jesper Grønkjær. I'm one of the few full-time magician in Denmark.
How did he end up doing wacky tricks for high school and university students in North Korea? Well, he contacted officials and just asked.
They don't understand magic, so I have to take pictures of all my props, my tricks, and then send it to North Korea.
After a lot of questions, they agreed. They even let Jesper film the whole thing. Of course, North Korea didn't say yes to everything.
I also asked, is it possible to come and make magic for Kim Jong-un? He said, no, it's not possible.
Once he got there, Jesper had two guards watching him constantly.
My two guards showed me what to see, what to eat, what to do in North Korea. It was not possible for me to do anything by myself.
Especially talk to citizens outside of his performances. They took him to a university classroom full of students wearing crisp white shirts and red lapel pins featuring past rulers Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. At first, the students were very stiff.
There was complete silence. They were looking down the table, but I asked him, come up, please stand up, and then I showed some magic.
He gathered them close and made one of them pick a card, then made a face like his head was gonna explode. That's Jesper pulling the card out of his mouth. As minders took him around Pyongyang and nearby towns, Jesper pushed his luck. He saw a stone-faced guard in a brown suit. She looked rigid, unapproachable.
In the beginning, she don't want to laugh, don't want to accept me or look at me.
But he went up to her, with a crowd watching, and did a little trick. He slipped something in her closed fist, and when she opened it, a zillion red clown noses spilled out everywhere. Her face lit up. Jesper went to North Korea just before COVID hit, but only released this footage in December on a Danish language YouTube outlet called Freeport Traveler. To his shock, it has racked up 4.5 million views and counting. He says the point is not to make North Korea's citizens seem happy living under tyranny. He just wanted to highlight the basic humanity everyone shares with regular North Korean people.
I try to make some space where it's okay to forget about the difficult things in life. Small moments where we could laugh together, not talk, but laugh together.
In the end, Jesper did manage to talk directly to some North Korean kids in a park, long enough to teach them a phrase he pulled from an old Disney movie, Cinderella.
Bibbidi-bobbidi-boo!
Bibbidi-bobbidi-boo! Total gibberish. But at least it got a laugh. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
And what have you got? Bibbidi-bobbidi-boo. Salagadoola, mentrikaboola, bibbidi-bobbidi-boo. It'll do magic, believe it or not. Bibbidi-bobbidi-boo.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin have a phone call planned tomorrow about ending the war in Ukraine. Trump said yesterday there is a very good chance of reaching a deal. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov confirmed this morning that the call would go ahead. Trump said that land and power plants will be part of his discussion with Putin tomorrow, which he described as, quote, dividing up certain assets. Meanwhile, in Ukraine, Jews mark the holiday of Purim over the weekend. The festival is a defiant celebration of survival each spring with costumes, carnivals, gifts, and, of course, cookies called hamantaschen. As the war with Russia grinds on, Jews in Ukraine say they're feeling more pride in their Ukrainian identity, as we hear from The World's Daniel Hoffman in Kyiv.
One of the most important traditions on Purim is reading the Book of Esther, a dramatic biblical tale of redemption in the face of destruction. The story is about a Jewish woman named Esther who saved her people from Haman, an advisor to the Persian king who hatched a plan to decimate all the Jews in the kingdom. The reversal of that destructive decree has been celebrated among Jews for more than 2,000 years. At the Simcha Chabad Jewish community in Kyiv, every time the name Haman comes up during the reading of the Book of Esther, the congregation makes a bunch of noise and boo the villainous Haman. After the reading of the Book of Esther, I caught up with David and his mom, Оля Драч.
Зараз хто Аман для всього світу? Росіяни.
Драч says, right now, who's Haman for the whole world? In the background, David says, it's Putin. Драч says, it's the Russians, all of them. Then David chimes in again.
All Russian people is like Aman. Yes. Like Aman, but for Ukrainian people, not for only Jews.
Драч speaks in rapid Ukrainian. Like many Ukrainians, she prefers to avoid speaking Russian. She says she feels strongly about her Jewish Ukrainian identity, and that's becoming more common in the Jewish community here. In the past, many saw themselves as Jews living in Ukraine rather than Ukrainian Jews. For decades, the Soviet leadership tried to squash both Jewish and Ukrainian national identities. Now, because of the war, many Jews are feeling a stronger sense of Ukrainian identity. Embracing the Ukrainian language is part of that.
У нас є велика проблема з мовою, з українською мовою.
Оля says, we do have a problem with the Ukrainian language in the Jewish community. She says that the process of switching from Russian to Ukrainian has been slow, but she sees some promising developments, like the translation of religious texts into Ukrainian. Галина Сталінська works with the Simcha Chabad Jewish community.
Молодежь старается говорить на украинском языке. Абсолютно все понимают украинский
язык. She says the younger generation is speaking more Ukrainian and all the events are in Ukrainian. At home, she says people speak a mix of languages, but overall there's a desire to develop both Jewish and Ukrainian identities. Сталінська says her kids, who grew up in an independent Ukraine, haven't faced Jewish slurs, which she says was common when she was growing up in the Soviet Union. Rabbi Moti and Devorah Levenhartz are the leaders of the Simcha Chabad Jewish community.
Еврейська община – это настоящее бомбоубежище вот по духовному смыслу. Вот это место.
The Jewish community is like a spiritual bomb shelter. The synagogue is always open. It's never closed, not since the start of the war.
Devorah Levenhart says when people lacked food, shelter, or electricity, they came to the Jewish Community Center, which is also a synagogue and a school. In the early days of the war, she says many people outside of Ukraine asked her and her husband why they didn't flee.
If you're here at this moment, that means you have a task. Maybe we were sent here specifically for this moment. So we couldn't abandon our community at a difficult time.
Rabbi Moti Levenhartz says the Jewish community faces a wide range of challenges because of the war. A big one is caring for military families. Rabbi Levenhartz says there are children at the school who are living with their grandparents because both of their parents are in the service. These families, he says, require special attention and assistance. He also says the community tries to support those who have been internally displaced.
We try to help them spiritually and physically. We've hired people who've been displaced by the war. It's important for people to know that they matter, that we value them and the work they do for our community.
Another focus for Rabbi Levenhartz is caring for the elderly, especially during Purim. At the Simcha Chabad Jewish community, elderly people come to pick up care packages. Lyudmila Ponomaryova just received hers. She says, there was a time when we had to hide our Jewish identity, like to get into university. Now things have changed, and we could be proud to be Jewish. Ponomaryova's friend, Lyuba Wenger, is standing nearby wearing a traditional Ukrainian embroidered shirt. She then shows me her Star of David necklace. She says this combination, the shirt and the Star of David, represents her pride in both of her identities, Ukrainian and Jewish. For The World, Daniel Hoffman, Kyiv, Ukraine.
Three planes landed in El Salvador yesterday, carrying hundreds of people deported from the United States. The Trump administration alleges that many of them are gang members from Venezuela. Trump quietly invoked a wartime law from 1798, the Alien Enemies Act, to justify those deportations. Flight records reviewed by the Washington Post reveal that the planes arrived in El Salvador hours after a U.S. judge ruled that the Trump administration could not use that law to deport migrants. We're going to focus on the fate of these deportees now that they're in El Salvador. Carlos Dada runs the Salvadoran digital news outlet El Faro. I asked him to describe the prison where the deportees are being held.
It's called the Center for the Containment of Terrorism, and it's the biggest prison in Latin America. It is a high-security prison where prisoners never see the light of the sun, where prisoners sleep in iron platforms without mattresses. They don't go out of their cells. They don't have legal assistance. They don't have visits.
When the deportees landed in El Salvador on Sunday, President Bukele posted this highly produced video of what happened. Let's just hear a bit of this. All right, so we hear this music and somebody saying nombre. Can you describe what we're actually seeing in these videos, Carlos?
What we see is a display of huge police force, not only receiving the deportees, but also driving them in a highly secured highway with what appears to be dozens of police cars and special vehicles. And then the deportees are brought in buses. When they reach the prison, they are brought down and submitted by police agents. A lot of them have their hair shaved off.
Yeah, and they all seem to be in cuffs and shackles, heads turned down, forced down, so they can't see where they're going. Now, these suspects were deported on suspicion of gang affiliation, but there was no trial, no evidence was presented. I understand it's possible some of the deportees are, in fact, legal U.S. residents, asylum seekers, or even just innocent bystanders. So you said that they don't have access in this prison to legal representation. Is that going to continue to be the case with these deportees?
We have no idea. Access to public information in El Salvador is all but existent. There is no way to get any public file. We don't know under which condition these people are. We don't even know who they are. According to Bukele, the 238 Venezuelans are members of this criminal organization, Tren de Aragua. But Venezuela issued a statement, an official statement, the government of Venezuela, saying that they are all migrants. And we learned from CBS that there's about a little bit more than 100 with some kind of link with Tren de Aragua, and the others, the more than 100, have been deported under normal migration procedures, but they have all been mixed in this prison. And there's also 23 Salvadorans, allegedly members of Mara Salvatrucha, that were also deported.
Right, that's another gang. So one of the Salvadorans deported this weekend is said to be a boss of MS-13.
Yes, he is. Cesar Lopez Larios is his name. He is a member of what it's called the boss's table of the MS-13, or La Ranfla in Spanish. But I have to add something, Marco. The prison system where these people are being sent by the United States is managed by the director of the prison system, a person called Osiris Luna Mesa, who has been sanctioned by the same State Department because of corruption and dealings with gangs. He has also been sanctioned by the Treasury Department through the laws Magnitsky and Engels list, as you know them. So this guy can't enter the United States. He's been accused of corruption. He's been accused of bringing back systematic torture to prisons. And he is still in charge of the whole prison system where the United States is sending these people.
Why did El Salvador's president Bukele and his government agree to take these men? What's in it for them?
The Salvadoran ambassador to the U.S. confessed that part of the agreement between Bukele and Secretary Rubio included sending back to El Salvador gang leaders. And the ambassador said it is a matter of honor for President Bukele. That's what we know so far.
How much will El Salvador actually be paid for this arrangement?
Well, if it's $20,000 per deportee, it's $6 million for the three airplanes that just arrived. What we don't know is how many more planes are coming.
Carlos Dada is the co-founder and director of the Salvadoran digital news outlet El Faro. A tropical storm that hit eastern Australia last week battered a 300-mile stretch of coastline and caused nearly $1 billion in damage. Local authorities and plenty of volunteers are working to clean up the destruction, including the beaches that attract millions of tourists every year. This was a rare storm, but it's just the latest example of increasingly extreme weather patterns in Australia. Climate change means the country can be facing multiple weather disasters at once. Lila Goldstein reports from Brisbane.
Ex-Cyclone Alfred has turned the pristine beaches along the Sunshine Coast and Gold Coast into steep cliffs that drop off yards away from the ocean waves.
Yeah, normally it's beautiful on the Gold Coast, perfect, so much sand, water's, crystal clear, blue.
Nathan Fife is about as familiar with these beaches as anyone could be. He's the Gold Coast Operations Manager for Surf Life Saving Queensland, which manages the lifeguard services here.
And unfortunately right now, you can't even get down the beach. The water's, brown, it looks like a chocolate milkshake.
Plus,
absolutely stinks down here at the moment.
Washed up seaweed is piled up on the sunken shoreline.
Yeah, that's the seaweed. Now it's sitting out in the sun. Going to smell a lot worse as the days go on. Never seen anything like this on the Gold Coast, ever.
Entire walkways are destroyed. A lifeguard stand sits askew after falling into the ocean, and long staircases are filled to the top with sand. In front of the Broad Beach Surf Life Saving Club, visitors like me now face a 10-foot drop in the sand before they can dip their toes in the ocean.
There's a massive cliff, basically, running down the whole beach.
Still, using makeshift ramps dug into the dune, a handful of brave tourists, joggers, and the obligatory man with a metal detector have made their way down. I try to join them.
Okay, let's see if I can make it.
Gold Coast Mayor Tom Tate says the city plans to have the beaches up and running again by the Easter holidays, when tourists tend to come. Excavators are already out on the beach attempting to level out some of the sand, and teams of relief workers are clearing away debris. But this beachside town is not the only place in Australia recovering from extreme weather.
Emergency services battling through the night and day to keep the fire away from Windy Harbour and other nearby communities.
On the other side of the continent, firefighters have been battling bushfires in Western Australia.
Residents in parts of Windy Harbour are being told it's too late to leave. The blaze has burned through more than 2,600 hectares of bushland.
While in the Adelaide Hills area, severe drought is driving people from their homes and threatening local food production as water runs out and dams dry up.
Conditions are starting to have devastating impacts on farmers across South Australia. Dairy producers at Mount Torrens in the Adelaide Hills today issuing an urgent plea for more support from the government.
In recent years, Australia has seen a series of extreme weather events. There were the unprecedented bushfires, or wildfires, of 2019 and 2020, where fires broke out across an area the size of the United Kingdom. Nearly 3 billion animals were killed or displaced. Last year was Australia's second hottest year on record. And just this February, North Queensland faced record-breaking floods.
Australia is the land of extremes.
Helen Bostock is an oceanographer at the University of Queensland. From floods to droughts to bushfires, she says Australia's weather patterns have always been highly variable. But rising temperatures in the ocean and atmosphere are impacting those natural weather processes and fueling these major disasters.
So it's that combination of these natural variability with the climate change that is leading to these more extreme conditions compared to what we've seen historically in the past.
Deserts cover about 18% of the mainland, and the continent is the second driest in the world after Antarctica. Annie Lau is a coastal geomorphologist at the University of Queensland.
The bushfire risk is quite high in many places, especially in a southern state where they are even drier and don't get as much rainfall.
And the country is getting even drier. The Bureau of Meteorology's 2024 State of the Climate Report predicts a continued increase in dangerous fires and a longer fire season in much of southern and eastern Australia. Meanwhile, the Australian region's annual sea surface temperatures in 2024 were the warmest on record, according to the Bureau.
So it is becoming more extreme.
Steve Turton is an adjunct professor of environmental geography at Central Queensland University. He says the devastating fires of 2019 and 2020 have been followed by a very wet period. And more intense rainfall means more growth of vegetation.
And of course, the pendulum will swing the other way. And when that happens, we will plunge into drought and the whole place will be primed for serious fires once again.
Australia is a global hotspot for climate change, he says, especially in the eastern half of the country, where most of the population lives.
We've always had those cycles, but these cycles are now becoming more pronounced.
Turton says climate change will continue to drive Australia's increasingly intense weather events, and that means more destruction and loss of life are likely to follow. For The World, I'm Lila Goldstein, Brisbane.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Fighting erupted last night along the border between Lebanon and Syria and continued today. Syria's interim government had accused Hezbollah militants based in Lebanon of crossing into Syria this weekend, kidnapping and killing three Syrian soldiers. Hezbollah has denied the accusation. Human rights observers say five more soldiers were killed today. Underlying the hostility in that border region, armed Lebanese groups who were closely allied with the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria, who was, as you'll recall, ousted by the new Syrian regime. When Bashar al-Assad's dictatorship was brought down in December and he fled Syria, it opened a new and uncertain chapter for the country and for millions of Syrians who fled his violence over the last decade or more. Today, we revisit the story of Syrian musician Samer Saim Eldar, who creates electronic sounds infused with Arabic classical music. His stage name? Hello, Psych Aleppo. In 2020, Eldar spoke with musician Mekhlit Hadero for our series Movement about the long journey he's been on since the Syrian civil war began in 2011.
So could you take us through the journey that you've been on, starting, I guess maybe it was a decade ago?
Yeah, 2012.
Lead us through it.
Totally. So I was studying fine arts in Aleppo and I graduated in 2012. And things started in Syria in 2011.
The scenes are unprecedented. Day after day of protest. Syrians now demanding what Tunisians and Egyptians have just won.
And things took off from there.
The answer came quickly and violently.
That moment, I was back in my studio in Aleppo and I was writing a piece for my first album called PH. It was so peaceful and like gunfires were like, you know, blasting outside. I was like just in a different place. I was like, what's happening outside doesn't really, I don't relate to it, you know. After that, I decided to go to Lebanon. I left Syria with a plan of going back after a month. I stayed there for like 3 years, actually. Starting 2015, they released a new law that doesn't allow foreigners, if they don't have a work permit, to stay in Lebanon. So because I was a freelancer, I had to leave to the U.S.
So at the time that you left Lebanon, Aleppo had just been devastated by fighting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you were feeling in this period?
As a musician, I felt very, very helpless. But then after that, like, I came to a conclusion that if I make like a youngster busy for 5 minutes to quit all that mess outside, I feel like that's like an act against war. That's the most I can do. We went to the States for 5 years. And after that, moved to Turkey to reunite with my parents. Because, you know, after the travel ban, I couldn't have my parents come to the U.S. even for a visit. That's one of the reasons I'm in Turkey right now.
Do you see yourself returning to Aleppo at some point?
That's a big question when you know, like, I know people went back after a while and they asked themselves, like, is this, like, Aleppo that we knew before? It's like everything has changed. The places that you knew aren't there anymore. In 2017, I released an album called To You. It's a conceptual album. Tuyur means birds in Arabic. So I collected old Arabic songs that talks about birds. The artist Esmahan, her song is called Ya Tuyur, Ghanni Hubbi. O birds, sing my love and chant my hopes.
Why birds?
Just the idea of it is freeing. You know, freedom of movement. Freedom of being with the, you know, with the ones you love. And you're always in a survival mode when you don't have that, you know?
That was Samer Saim Eldar, otherwise known as Hello Psych Aleppo. He's released many albums since this original interview, including 2024's Cypher. But Tuyur remains one of my favorites. I had been wondering how Samer was feeling amidst the recent changes in Syria. And then in December of last year, he posted a photo on his socials that answered all my questions. In it, he and his son were sitting in a big, comfy chair, wearing soft winter robes, looking each other directly in the face. There seemed to be tears in Samer's eyes, and the words he wrote to go along with that photo were so compelling that we asked him to record himself reading them out loud so you could hear them in his own voice.
That was the moment I read the news that al-Assad ran away. A realization that Syria is finally free. At that same moment, my son came to me and sat on my lap to congratulate me. In that instant, I realized that I could finally introduce him to my whole family, my home, my friends, a world he knows nothing about. I've often suppressed memories to protect myself and keep moving forward, but not anymore. Aleppo, are you ready for Psych Aleppo?
That was Syrian musician Samer Saim Eldar speaking with Maklit Hedero. To hear more stories at the crossroads of music and migration, search for Movement with Maklit Hedero wherever you listen to podcasts. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online at theworld.org and subscribe to The World wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow.
Supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Glasscock Heritage Trust, Jennifer Woodruff, Cindy Engels, Merle Kurtzrock and George Zimmerman, and Carrie and Nelson Hoffman. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.